This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 56 of What's It Like. My guest is Dazeen Huber, who is in somewhere in Canada. But how far east are you?
Well, right now, we're my family and I are out on Prince Edward Island, which is almost as far east in Canada as you can get. It's sort of huddled up next to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, just north and a little bit east, I guess, of Maine, basically.
Yeah. It's a pretty island, though.
It is very pretty. It's a great place. We come out here an awful lot. It's a nice little place. It's our Canada's smallest province geographically and population-wise as well.
So the island is a province by itself?
The island is a province by itself, and it's about, I think if I recall, about 130,000-140,000 people on it. So not very populous at all. Quite small, I guess. You'll probably drive from one end to the other in a little bit over 3 hours.
Do you live there year-round?
No. Generally, we live in my family. I live in British Columbia, which is on the exact opposite end of the country, in the west.
Closer to Vancouver?
Yeah, sort of. Vancouver is in British Columbia, but it's about the city we live in is called Prince George, and it's about I'm trying to think in miles here, probably about 400 miles north of Vancouver, right in the
center
of the province, basically.
That's a pretty area. I grew up in Seattle and lived in Alaska for a while, so I'm familiar with the area.
Yeah, you had to travel right through Prince George if you drove to Alaska from Seattle.
That's true. Yeah. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Calgary, which is in Alberta, which is one province over from BC. It's just north of Montana.
I was there for the Calgary Stampede.
Calgary is home to the Calgary Stampede, and Canada's oil industry is based out of Calgary as well.
Kind of the Texas of Canada.
Alberta's sort of the Texas of Canada, except we have Banff and stuff like that, the Rocky Mountains and other things too. So yeah, there are bona fide cowboys there as well, and oil rigs and the whole lot. So.
Did you come from a large family?
I have two sisters in my family and both of my parents, so five of us in total.
So who had the biggest influence on your life growing up?
In terms of people, I would say my parents would be my biggest influence of all. They were always encouraging and helped me see a lot of interesting took me along to see a lot of interesting experiences and encouraged me through my schooling and different endeavors and stuff as a kid growing up. So they were definitely my biggest influence.
What was your major challenge as a child?
I've been a little bit introverted. I've learned in later years to compensate for that by being a bit of an extrovert, if you know what I mean. It's sort of strangely counterintuitive, but up until, I would say, at least late junior high or so, I was a reasonably introverted guy, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It let me spend a lot of time reading and learning and contemplating things as well, and I had a small group of friends. But sometimes, of course, that can be a challenge as well. I think just as much as people probably don't realize that being an extrovert can be a challenge. As challenges as well too, but it can. And I think in my later years now, I probably compensated for that by trying to push myself in the other direction. And I guess early on, I definitely was a fairly quiet kid and contemplative. It meant that I didn't have tons and tons of friends at school all the time, but I had my few friends here and there and things to do. But I think that's probably one of them. I had no really major illnesses. I grew up with asthma for quite a while, which cut back a little bit on some of my athletic endeavors. But as I got older, I sort of learned how to manage that as well and started taking up a few sports as well too. So I can't say that I had, I think in general I would say I lived a pretty blessed life as a kid. I didn't have anything that, um, any anything that's out of the ordinary in terms of difficulties or challenges, I guess that was.
How did you in school get along?
Pretty well, especially when I got to university through grade school and into high school as well, especially early on. I think I often would get report cards back that said, you know, he's a little bit absent-minded or he daydreams too much. And I'm not sure if that was because I just had a lot of other things to think about, probably was. And then as I got into high school, things started clicking a little bit more in terms of me feeling that I was being challenged and interested by the subject matter. And when I got into university, that's when I really enjoyed what I was doing and really clicked with the subject matter and started, you know, enjoying it for the sake of the knowledge and the insight that I would get from my professors rather than just for the sake of marks, which I think up until even, 11th and 12th grade, there were times that I know that I was enjoying things for the sake of learning, but it was still for the sake of the marks. And when I pulled into university, that's where I started enjoying things for the sake of the actual, combined wisdom and knowledge of the ages that was being imparted to me, which was great. And as I enjoyed it more, I also found that it was a lot easier to get good marks as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it was for me as well. Yeah.
So what exactly do you do?
I'm a professor. I'm in a department called the Ecosystem and Science Management Program at the University of Northern British Columbia, which is a small university in Prince George. It has we teach undergraduates, and we also have a graduate program there, so people do masters and PhDs there as well. There's I believe it depends how you count it, full time equivalent to actual butts and seats, as they say. There's I think about 4,000 or so students there at any given time. It's not a huge university, but we really pride ourselves in the fact that we can give a really good high quality education to students in smaller class settings, oftentimes much smaller than you're from Seattle, so University of Washington or University of British Columbia or other places like that. Our first year classes are big for in terms of our perspective, but they're nothing like some of these humongous first-year classes that most freshmen would find themselves in. And in terms of graduate schooling, there we're also we really are able to focus in on things like natural resources management and forestry and ecology related to the region that we're in, small town and rural development and health issues. And we also have a med school there as well, so a lot of some medical research and rural medicine type of work and research as well. So that's the university I work at. I'm a professor of biology there. So I teach biology, and I have graduate students and other people working in my lab in a research program there.
So the courses that you teach, are they in a particular aspect of biology?
The two courses I mainly teach at the undergraduate level, one is molecular cell physiology, and that it's related to how the cells in our bodies all work together, and the very small, I guess you might call them even machines within the cell that help to regulate the cell's activities and tell cells when to divide and when to stop dividing, and how cells operate in relation to each other. So we look at developmental biology, how animals develop from an egg and a sperm come together, and then that cell divides into 2 and into 4 and into 8 and 16, and eventually you get a fully functioning separate organism, a baby or whatever. So that we look at that type of stuff. And I also teach another course called Animal Behavior, which is exactly what it sounds like. We look at why animals do what they do, how they find food or mates, or how they defend territories, or why they choose certain territories, and things like that. So those are both, actually, strangely enough, they seem very much at opposite ends of the biological spectrum, but because of my background training, they're both well within the within my realm of knowledge and learning in the past. So it's fun to teach them. The students in the two different courses are often fairly different because the molecular cell physiology students really enjoy looking at, you know, looking down the levels, how small things work to make a larger whole. The animal behavior students often really like to integrate all sorts of different information to see how systems work at a larger level. And I get crossover as well. There's students who go into both courses as well and I think are able to find some really interesting links. So, yeah, so those are the two main courses I teach. And I teach a few graduate courses as well, and I've taught a few other undergraduate courses of different kinds too.
What is your area of research?
I'm what you would call an entomologist, broadly speaking. An entomologist is a person that studies insects.
You're a bug guy.
I'm a bug guy, and I do what's specifically called forest entomology for the most part. So I look at insects that are in the forest, and on top of that, I also sort of could be called a chemical ecologist in terms of a lot of my research as well. I look at how organisms, in this case insects, and some of the insects either with each other or with the plants that they feed on, how organisms communicate or interact with each other using chemicals. So oftentimes we think of pheromones as chemicals that that creatures communicate with each other. And so that's one aspect of it. Other aspects, the stuff I'm sort of more interested in tends to be how plants defend themselves against insect herbivory. So how a plant might have particular chemicals in its leaves or its stem or other parts of its structure, so that when an insect starts feeding on it, the insect is maybe deterred from feeding on it, or even potentially poisoned in some way or another. So chemical ecology is how organisms communicate with each other using chemicals, and I specifically look at how forest insects and plants do that with each other. So that's in a sort of a nutshell, that's my research.
Hmm. What's the best thing about your job?
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot of good things. I have to say, being a professor it's a very interesting job. I don't know. The students that I interact with, I mean, there's so many excellent students that I bump into on a daily basis, either really directly under my mentorship in my lab. I've had some very excellent students there at different times and currently, or sort of a little bit less directly and sort of in larger class contexts as well. And some of those students end up working in my lab at different times. So those interactions are great. I really value being able to sit down and talk to interested students about these different systems that we're looking at. The fact that I get to, you know, research things that I really enjoy, and sometimes, you know, I have my current research foci are very, you know, there's a few specific things that I'm looking at, but every now and then other interesting things come up, or I bump into other colleagues that have interesting ideas that sort of mesh with my expertise, and we were able to pull together interesting collaborations. And, you know, being able to just learn about these things, sit and read other people's insights and ideas about particular systems, and being able to teach them to others. There's so many great things about being a professor. I think it's a very rewarding job. It's very interactive with other people, whether they're your colleagues or your students, and sometimes your students become your colleagues later on down the line as well, or just, you know, just sheer, just being able to be a scholar as well. It's great. I can't speak highly enough of it. It's not the easiest job in the world to get, because there's a lot of work that you need to do to get there, but it's certainly very rewarding, and the work getting there is rewarding as well.
What's the worst thing about your job?
okay, let's see here. I wish I could say this is off the record. and I mean, some other professors would probably enjoy these sorts of things as well. I mean, there's certain this sort of bureaucratic type of stuff that goes on in universities as well that you have to live with or help to, you know, develop policy and other things like that as well. And some of those things, you know, sometimes it's actually rewarding. I worked for the last few years on a curriculum committee that helped to develop the biology curriculum at our university. And I have to say that's a rewarding thing because we're able to look at what students are experiencing and where the world is going in terms of biological education and tweak our program in certain ways that way. But other times there's, you know, it's a large institution, even though we're at a small university, it's still a reasonably large institution. And there's, you know, various bits of policy that sometimes bump into things that you want to get done. And that can be frustrating at times. But the, you know, on the flip side of it, the way to help with that is when is to actually be involved in the policy making process, I guess, in a positive, constructive way and not just, you know, sort of sniff at it and say, well, this policy is ridiculous here. What are we doing? You know, instead say, well, why don't we try to do something else and try to find ways to be part of making a positive change. I mean, a lot of red tape and policy in any particular situation, you know, it's there for historical reasons or because of, you know, five other regulations that force another regulation to exist that interferes with, for instance, research or other things. But the way to deal with it is to try to get to the nub of the issue. And sometimes things can't be dealt with, and that's frustrating, but you just have to keep on going. So, I don't know. I would say bureaucratic red tape, I guess, in a generic sense. But like I said, there's ways to make, I guess, to take that and make it into something good as well if you want to be positive about it.
If there's people, there's politics.
There always is. And I mean, yeah, politics, bureaucracy, policy, all those things. But, you know, it's, I guess there's different ways that people deal with it. You can sort of try to avoid it as much as you can, or you can try to engage with it as well in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
I think engaging with it in a negative way is never, is always going to bite you in the back end eventually.
What type of person would be good at your job?
That's an interesting question because there's a lot, it's a very, when you look at personalities, I guess there's a wide swath of sort of general personalities that I see at any university, but and I guess there are some generalities. It should be someone that's interested in what they're doing, and interested in the particular system that they're going to be looking at. So, I mean, I wouldn't be a biology professor if I didn't think that biology in general was really cool. So, you know, if you want to teach English or teach geology or engineering or visual arts or other things, you have to have a real passion for it. You can't just decide today I want to be a visual arts professor and have never, you know, picked up a paintbrush or a camera or anything like that in your life. You need to start to see how much you like it and develop a passion for it. And everyone that I know that's a successful professor has a passion for something. And the other thing about being a successful professor, I think, is that while you have a passion for a particular thing, you're always looking beyond that as well to try to see the larger implications and just a general passion for knowledge and learning as well. So those are, I would say, the main characteristics. In terms of, you know, I mean, you, in terms of, I think, being a good teacher, you have to be able to be a bit of a, I don't know if it's the right term, but an actor or something. You have to be able to get in front of your class and draw out their emotions and thoughts and ideas on the subject in a good way. We've all had teachers that just come up in front of the class and drone on for about an hour or so and don't engage anybody. You need to be able to really capture people's imaginations as well. And that comes with practice. That's not, you know, I mean, there's some, you know, these few individuals that are prodigies in anything, right? And they'll step into a classroom situation and because of their specific personality and ability, they'll be engaging immediately in any subject. You know, they can be teaching the driest thing on earth and engage a class. But for most of us, that comes with practice, but at least a willingness to practice that. I've heard it said somewhere, and this goes for anything, I would think, that it takes about 10,000 hours of practice to become a real, you know, expert or proficient at something, really proficient at something. And my guess is that that's the same deal with teaching. And it'll be the same deal with whatever you're developing a passion for in terms of being an academic as well. You know, you need to be spending the time with the subject matter in some way or another.
So how would, if one wanted to, how would one get a job like yours?
To teach and do research at a university, you need to have a PhD. And so to do that, you'd have to do a bachelor's degree somewhere, a bachelor of science or bachelor of arts or a bachelor's degree in a subject, at least largely related to what you think you want to end up being a professor as. And sometime during your bachelor's degree, you should be finding your way into a graduate program, doing a master's somewhere, and then moving on beyond that into a PhD, which is further graduate research beyond the master's. So typically a bachelor's degree takes about 4 years, give or take, and a master's degree in science anyhow usually takes about 2, maybe 2.5 years or so, and then a PhD probably another 4 years, sometimes 5 years after that as well. So it's not a short haul by any stretch, but you have to be coming out of high school with good enough marks to get into a university that offers bachelor's degrees to start on the track, and you have to sort of keep your marks up reasonably well and develop a strong interest. And even during your bachelor's degree too, you should be finding ways to be conducting research as well with a professor at the university that you're at. So whether it's, you know, in social sciences or in biology or chemistry or whatever, you should find a way to spend, you know, a summer or two working with a professor as a lab assistant or assistant to one of the graduate students or something like that, conducting research so that you have an idea as to whether or not you actually like research, and then go from there.
Where did you get your undergraduate?
I did my undergraduate degree in zoology at the University of Calgary, which is in Alberta,
mm-hmm.
Southern Alberta. I spent time there working in a lab doing molecular biology on some particular bacteria, and I actually was able to have my name as a co-author on a published paper that resulted partly from my research. And after that, again, now some places require you to have a master's degree before you start a PhD. Others let you right into a PhD, especially if you have a publication or other experience like that behind your name. And I did my PhD work at Simon Fraser University, which is in Burnaby, British Columbia, which is part of the Greater Vancouver area. And I didn't do a master's degree because I went straight from a bachelor's to my PhD in that case. And did my PhD there on a group of insects called bark beetles, which are little insects, as their name implies, little beetles, as the name implies, that go underneath the bark of trees, and that's where they reproduce. And they bring in a fungus into the tree that helps to kill the tree, and all the working underneath the bark of the tree kills the tree, and a new brood comes out, and oftentimes they can erupt into large infestations as well. So I did my work there with my senior supervisor is a fellow named John Borden, who's still active in industry and research in industry right now. And that's where I did my PhD.
If there is such a thing, what is a typical day like for you?
I don't know. It's not. I guess it is slightly typical. You know, I mean, I catch the bus in the morning and get into work at a, you know, pretty normal time for most people who go into work. I guess my first thing in the morning is to check my emails. I try not to be a slave to my email because that's very easy to do. So I check my emails, see if there's anything that needs to be dealt with immediately. Try to clear out my inbox as much as possible. If it's a teaching day, if I have a class coming up, I'll usually spend the morning preparing for the class, making sure that I have all of my notes and slides and other things in order, and that I know what I'm going to be saying and talking about in class. If it's not a teaching day, I probably will launch into other types of work, maybe reading something that needs a paper from a colleague, or writing on a paper that I'm working on, or dealing with, if I'm on a particular committee, dealing with some of the committee type work things, you know, that sort of stuff. It's hard to say that, you know, I do this, and this as the day progresses. But like I said, if it's a teaching day, my first priority is always to the class coming up. And beyond that, you know, it's just talking to the people working in my lab or making sure that I'm helping to push the research type priorities through as well. My Fridays, I try to, generally speaking, on Fridays as well, meet with everybody who's working in my research program for at least a short period of time. So I try to do it at least once a week, and I typically devote chunks of Friday to that because it's sort of a good time of the week to recap what's gone on in the past week and think about the upcoming week. So I tend to have sort of 15-minute or half-hour appointments with everybody that's working in my research program so that I touch base with them in my office at least once a week. So that's sort of a typical thing. I mean, yeah, it's between that type of thing and sort of regularly scheduled meetings and regularly scheduled class time, you know, there's a fair amount of freedom to actually get these things done as well. So it's not, I mean, I could theoretically work at 11 o'clock at night if I wanted to. I'm a terrible worker at 11 o'clock at night, but I mean, I know some people that do that as well. So as long as you're there for the regularly scheduled things and you're getting it done in between, you have a fair amount of freedom to get it done.
So, Dazeen, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
That's a good question. I guess there's different ways of doing it. Two of the ways that I do it, either I like to attend scientific meetings at least once or twice a year, or sometimes a little bit more if I can, to, you know, talk to my colleagues and also, you know, see some of the interesting new things that are going on. And oftentimes, just being at those meetings and seeing other people and talking to them and hearing about their research and different presentations is a good way to sort of spur me. It gives me new ideas oftentimes or spurs me on to, you know, push a little bit harder with the work that's going on in my lab as well. So that's definitely one way. And so if I can't attend meetings for whatever reason, which is, you know, because I'm teaching or I have other commitments, I'm not traveling isn't my favorite thing either because of my family. I don't like being gone for vast stretches of time. So it's not like I'm going to go to 8 or 10 meetings a year. So the other thing is just, you know, finding interesting new papers that my colleagues and other people, sometimes people I don't even know, of course, publish. And those things, being able to sit down and read interesting research and think about these things helps to spur me on in terms of my own research and just the excitement of the research that I'm doing and that other people are doing that I hear about as well, I think helps to spur me on to be a better teacher as well and try to pull out some of these interesting new findings to show to my students and get them interested and hyped up a little bit as well. So I guess other people in terms of their ideas help to spur me on, and hopefully my ideas help to spur others on as well. Hopefully it's a positive feedback cycle, I guess.
Well, let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I'm a Christian, a Bible-believing Christian, and I really oftentimes just being able to stop and pray, I guess, in other traditions, maybe people would call it meditation or other things like that, but stopping and praying and just spending time with Jesus that way is one thing that helps me. Allowing myself to think carefully about the grand scheme of things and, you know, the big picture and looking off into beyond this, you know, this temporal life that we live and into eternity, I guess. It's, you know, you can easily get caught up in these really small, you know, details and even sometimes big details, things that seem extremely huge right now, but when you look at it in the grand scheme of things and you just take a moment to pull yourself back and realize, you know, that this is not something that's insurmountable. It's one of those, it sometimes can help you to get a bigger perspective. Just before taking this phone call, I was just down on the beach below the cape that we live on up here, and because of this hurricane that's been whipping through the waves, I mean, it's just amazing to think. So the hurricane that's come through here right now, Hurricane Irene, just sort of, or the remnant of Hurricane Irene, it's just sort of been passing off to the west of us here. So we're on the very edge of the remnants of what was a hurricane. But even that, I mean, it's amazing. These winds out there are blowing like you can't believe right now. So imagine what it was like actually in the real hurricane when it hit, for instance, you know, Vermont or Carolinas down there. And the waves are just flying, and all this energy from this hurricane has been transferred into the waves and the wind. And that's huge, huge, and unbelievable. And that's just one small little part of our very large world, which is just one small, tiny part of our galaxy in this huge universe. And so when you stop to look at these things, this world around us, you know, it's an unbelievable thing, and it really can help to, I think, center you a little bit and think about how even though we're very small, I believe that God cares for each one of us, and even though our problems seem very small in the grand scheme of things, even though they end up seeming large to us, but He cares for each of us. It says in the Bible somewhere that God sees, you know, even a sparrow fall. And so if that's the case, then He cares, you know, a great deal for each of us. And so, I don't know, it's a stepping back and a perspective thing. I guess different people have different ways of doing that and different beliefs as well, but that's how I do it.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
There's certain times, and I guess you look back at it and you think, wow, you know, I got through those sorts of things, and I always wonder how significant they are. When I hear about other people that have extreme challenges, I oftentimes think that I have nothing to compare it to. You know, right now there's a famine off there in East Africa, right? And I think about some family there, who's, you know, just trying to survive on a day-to-day basis, and I just can't compare anything that's happened in my life to some of these vast challenges that people face around the world right now. So I don't know. I guess since my life sort of revolves around academia, sometimes there's certainly been some challenges throughout my academic life that have made me, you know, really have to focus in extremely diligently on the work that I was doing and the learning that I was doing as well. But yeah, I mean, those things seem very trite compared to the things that people go through, that I have to admit, I don't think I've really gone through in any way.
If you were giving a commencement address for college graduation, what would be your best advice?
I think it would be to really, love what you're doing. And if you don't love what you're doing, then, find something else to do. But always make sure that when you're loving what you're doing, you're doing things, you're doing what you're doing because of other people as well. And don't forget the fact that whatever you do, if it's going to have any worth in the long run, it has to be done with other people, and, you know, the earth that we live on in mind as well. If what you're doing is strictly for your own benefit, ultimately, I don't think it's going to be very rewarding. Even if it helps you to make, you know, for instance, millions of dollars and live a lavish lifestyle, I don't think you'd find you'd find it in any way rewarding. But the reality, of course, is a lot of the people that are most successful out there in whatever they happen to be doing also really love what they're doing and are able to do things that that benefit others as well. So that would be what I would say.
My last question is a little odd, but that's so am I. So that's how it comes. If you were doing your life over, what's the one thing you wouldn't change?
One thing I would not change?
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't. I don't think I would change you know, the diverse experiences that I've had. As kids, we generally lived in Calgary growing up, but we also moved to, we lived in Germany a couple of times and in California, and I've lived in California and in Vancouver and other places as an adult as well. And being able to see all those different places and experience, you know, cultures, you know, that are reasonably variable at least, and meet so many people in these different places has been good for me, I think. I mean, a lot of people, I think, can do quite well living in one place their entire life and developing a really strong network in a community. And, you know, overall in my life, I've had the benefit of being, you know, reasonably stable in two or three different communities at different times and developing a network that way, which is good, but also being able to see and meet different people has been vital, I think. And help, you know, understanding the fact that in different places, people do things in different ways. And that's not necessarily right or wrong. It's the way that it's done in that particular spot. And understanding that just because I don't necessarily understand why they're doing something at this point, in this particular way, doesn't mean that it's wrong, and what they need to do is stop to understand why they are doing whatever they're doing in a certain way. So, yeah, cultural experience, I guess, is something I would not change.
I want to thank Dazeen Huber for joining me today. Thanks, Dazeen. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was interesting. And good luck with this program. It sounds like a great program.